words he would use to save capitalism would be bold, visionary, and humane. They would transform American life for decades, perhaps longer. Though clearly not a radical, Roosevelt laid out an ambitious recovery program during his first 100 days in office. It included the Agricultural Adjustment Administration to save farming, the Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, to put young men to work in the forests and parks, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, FERA, under Harry Hopkins, to provide federal assistance to the states, the Public Works Administration, PWA, under Harold Ickes, to coordinate large-scale public works projects, the Glass-Steagall Banking Act, which separated investment and commercial banking, and instituted federal insurance of bank deposits, and the National Recovery Administration, NRA, to promote industrial recovery. Established by the National Industrial Recovery Act, NIRA, which Roosevelt considered the most important and far-reaching legislation ever enacted by the American Congress, the NRA was modeled in part on the War Industries Board, WIB, which Bernard Baruch had directed during World War I. The NRA suspended antitrust laws, effectively sounding the death knell for laissez-faire capitalism. Centralized planning would instead revitalize the shattered economy. Under the NRA, each industry drew up its own code covering wages, prices, production, and working conditions. The largest corporations dominated the code-setting process in their respective industries, with labor and consumer groups playing, at best, a minor role. The initial NIRA legislation was hastily cobbled together and did not provide clear guidelines for what was to follow. Many liberals applauded it. The nation welcomed it as a step toward a collectivized society. It was Roosevelt's choice of General Hugh Johnson to administer the NRA that gave it its distinctive coloration. Johnson was Baruch's man. They had worked closely together on the WIB. After retiring from the Army, Johnson became an advisor to Baruch in his business dealings. Johnson's leadership of the NRA has fueled allegations that the New Deal was fascistic, a nonsensical and dangerous notion later peddled by Ronald Reagan and, more recently, by conservative writer Jonah Goldberg. Reagan touched a raw nerve when he said during the 1976 presidential campaign that fascism was really the basis of the New Deal. Johnson was the exception rather than the rule. He did not hide his fascist sympathies. In September 1933, he reviewed the 2-million-strong NRA parade down New York's Fifth Avenue. Time magazine reported, "General Johnson, his hand raised in a continuous fascist salute, had declared the parade to be the most marvelous demonstration I have ever seen." Johnson gave Francis Perkins a copy of Raffaello Viglione's fascist tract, The Corporate State. Roosevelt finally removed him because of his erratic behavior, abrasive personality, heavy drinking, and penchant for antagonizing labor. In his deeply emotional farewell speech, he celebrated the shining name of Benito Mussolini. There was great uncertainty about where Roosevelt was taking the country, leading some observers to compare the United States with fascist Italy. The Quarterly Review of Commerce wrote in autumn 1933, "Some see in his program a movement toward a form of American fascism. In fact, the tremendous concentration of power in the hands of the president, the new codes under the National Industrial Recovery Act regulating competition, the fixing of minimum wage rates, of maximum working hours in industry, and the general policy of economic planning and coordination of production all strongly suggest the essential features of the Italian fascist program." The writer described Johnson's anti-labor proclivities, including his delivering, on October 10th, a warning to labor in no uncertain terms that strikes were unnecessary under the Roosevelt plan, and that no opposition of any kind would be tolerated. Although a plethora of right-wing groups emerged during the 1930s, the fascist threat that Sinclair Lewis warned about in his 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, never took hold in the United States. That is not to say that Mussolini and Hitler lacked admirers. Time and fortune were unabashed supporters of Mussolini. In 1934, the editors of Fortune magazine extolled Italian fascism, which embodied certain ancient virtues of the race, including discipline, duty, courage, glory, sacrifice. Many American legionnaires felt the same way. Legion commander Alvin Ousley declared in 1923 that the fascisti are to Italy what the American Legion is to the United States, and the organization invited Mussolini to address its national convention in 1930. Elected officials, including Pennsylvania Senator David Reed, praised Mussolini and proclaimed, "If this country ever needed a Mussolini, it needs one now." Hitler, too, had more than his share of U.S. defenders. Among the more notorious was Republican Congressman Louis T. McFadden of Pennsylvania. He took to the floor of the House in May 1933 to decry the international Jewish conspiracy, reading passages from The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an anti-Semitic screed purporting to prove a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world, into the congressional record, and announcing that the president's abandonment of the gold standard had given the gold and lawful money of the country to the international money Jews, of whom Franklin D. Roosevelt is the familiar. "This country has fallen into the hands of the international money changers," he charged. "Is it not true," McFadden asked, "that in the United States today, the Gentiles have the slips of paper, while the Jews have the gold and the lawful money? And is not this repudiation bill a bill specifically designed and written by the Jewish international money changers in order to perpetuate their power?" The infamous radio priest of Royal Oak, Michigan, Father Charles Coughlin, took to the airwaves to proclaim his corporatist and increasingly anti-Semitic vision. His weekly publication, Social Justice, serialized the protocols and urged followers to join the Christian Front armed militia. Gallup reported in 1938 that 10% of American families owning radios listened to Coughlin's sermons on a regular basis, and 25% did so occasionally. 83% of the steady listeners approved of the priest's messages. Even in 1940, Social Justice had over 200,000 readers weekly. Even farther to the right were the so-called shirt movements, which took their inspiration from Mussolini's black shirts and Hitler's brown shirts. William Dudley Pelley's Silver Legion may have enlisted as many as 25,000 members in 1933. In Kansas, Gerald Winrod, the Jayhawk Nazi, whose Defender newspaper reached 100,000 readers, garnered 21% of the Republican vote in the Kansas U.S. Senate primary in 1938. With West Virginia's Knights of the White Camellia, Philadelphia's khaki shirts, Tennessee's Crusader white shirts, and New York City's Christian mobilizers, the country was awash in extremists. One of the most violent of these organizations was the Midwest-based Black Legion, which had split off from the Ku Klux Klan in 1925. Wearing black robes instead of the Klan's white sheets, the Legion had a membership estimated at between 60,000 and 100,000 in 1935. Its head, electrician Virgil Effinger, spoke openly about the need for mass extermination of American Jews before the federal government cracked down on the group in 1937. Although not a shirter, a failed haberdasher, Harry Truman, had earlier applied for membership in the Klan, before thinking the better of it. In reality, Hugh Johnson's influence on the New Deal was fleeting, and the far right's non-existent. Not only did the New Deal reject fascist solutions, it resisted attempts to impose any unified, coherent philosophy. It was more of a hodgepodge of agencies. Raymond Moley wrote that viewing the New Deal as the product of a consistent plan was to believe that the accumulation of stuffed snakes, baseball pictures, school flags, old tennis shoes, carpenter's tools, geometry books, and chemistry sets in a boy's bedroom could have been put there by an interior decorator. Roosevelt was more pragmatic than ideological, and he was willing to allow government to play a vastly bigger role than any of his predecessors could have imagined. Roosevelt focused from the outset on jump-starting the U.S. economy and getting Americans back to work. Solving international problems would take a back seat. He made that abundantly clear at the World Economic Conference in London in July 1933. He had already issued executive orders to release U.S. monetary policy from the constraints of gold in April, but held out the prospect of returning the United States and, if possible, the rest of the world to the gold standard. By the summer, however, he had had a change of heart. So, when confronted with the choice between an inflationary economic recovery program at home and going along with the Europeans' demand for currency stabilization and a restored international gold standard, Roosevelt opted for the former. Fully expecting that Roosevelt would go along with the joint declaration by Great Britain and the gold bloc nations to return to the gold standard and halt speculation in exchange rates, the 54 world leaders attending the London summit were taken aback by Roosevelt's July 3rd announcement that the United States would be party to neither exchange rate stabilization nor a gold standard. The conference broke up, leaving most European leaders bitterly disappointed. Many, including Hitler, concluded that the United States was withdrawing from world affairs. Back home, Roosevelt received a mixed response. Certain business and banking titans, including Frank A. Vanderlip, J.P. Morgan, and Irene DuPont, offered measured support, at least in public. Moley surmised that 9 out of 10 bankers, even those in the lower part of Manhattan, supported Roosevelt's rejection of the gold standard. But former Democratic presidential candidate turned New Deal critic Al Smith dismissed Roosevelt's monetary policy, calling it a commitment to baloney dollars instead of gold dollars. Smith expressed astonishment that the Democratic Party is fated to be always the party of greenbackers, free silverites, rubber dollar manufacturers, and crackpots. Moley's assurances notwithstanding, many bankers adamantly opposed Roosevelt's currency measures. The Federal Reserve Advisory Council, made up of leading bankers throughout the nation, warned the Federal Reserve Board that economic recovery required a gold standard. "Demands for currency inflation and further credit inflation," the council instructed, "rest upon reasoning again and again proved to be a tragic illusion." The most scathing condemnation of both Roosevelt and his currency decisions, however, came from the Chamber of Commerce. After rejecting a resolution offering support for Roosevelt's monetary policy, the New York State Chamber applauded when railroad magnate Leonor F. Lorry declared that "the ending of the gold standard was as great a violation of trust and a denial of what is printed on that bill as was Germany's wartime disregard for Belgium's neutrality." By the next May, having been bludgeoned with a constant barrage of criticism, Roosevelt felt compelled to send a letter to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's annual convention, asking members to stop crying wolf and to cooperate in working for recovery. But businessmen's attacks on Roosevelt and his New Deal policies intensified. In October 1934, Time noted that businessmen's enmity toward Roosevelt had become quite personal. It was no longer a matter of business v. government, but of business v. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt's inward-looking approach was apparent across the board. He repudiated his earlier support for joining the League of Nations and willingly sacrificed foreign trade in order to stimulate domestic recovery. He even took steps to reduce the country's 140,000-man army, which prompted a visit by Secretary of War George Dern. Dern brought along General Douglas MacArthur, who told the president that he was endangering the country's safety. In his memoirs, MacArthur recalled, "The president turned the full vials of his sarcasm upon me. He was a scorcher when aroused. The tension began to boil over. I spoke recklessly and said something to the general effect that when we lost the next war and an American boy lying in the mud with an enemy bayonet through his belly and an enemy foot on his dying throat spat out his last curse, I wanted the name not to be MacArthur but Roosevelt." The president grew livid. "You must not talk that way to the president," he roared. MacArthur, overwrought, apologized, offered his resignation as chief of staff, rushed outside, and vomited on the White House steps. Openly opposing Wall Street and the military made for smart politics in 1930s America, and Roosevelt was nothing if not an astute politician. The 1934 midterm elections showed how far to the left the country had moved. In fact, much of the electorate was to the left of the New Deal. In a remarkable break with normal voting patterns, the party in power drubbed the opposition. The Democrats won 26 of 35 Senate races, giving them a 69-25 advantage over Republicans in the upper chamber, with one seat being held by a progressive and one by a farmer laborite. Their lead in the House jumped to 322-103, with seven progressives and three farmer laborites. The New York Times called it the most overwhelming victory in the history of American politics, giving the president a clear mandate and literally destroying the right wing of the Republican Party. Viewing the election as a wake-up call for Republicans, Idaho Republican Senator William Borah told reporters that, "Unless the Republican Party is delivered from its reactionary leadership and reorganized in accordance with its one-time liberal principles, it will die like the Whig Party of sheer political cowardice." He criticized his party's leadership for opposing the New Deal without offering a program of their own in place of it. Borah complained that when Republicans around the country ask their leaders for an alternative to the New Deal, they are offered the Constitution, but people can't eat the Constitution. Radical ideas were in the air. Upton Sinclair, author of The Jungle, almost won election as governor of California with a campaign called End Poverty in California that proposed handing uncultivated farms to farmers and idle factories to workers for productive use. California physician Francis Townsend's call for giving people over age 60 $200 a month to stimulate the economy won numerous adherents, and Louisiana Governor Huey Long's Share the Wealth program, with its Soak the Rich tax plan, offered another vision for redistribution of wealth and a more just and egalitarian society. The Soviet Union, which would later become such an albatross around the necks of American leftists when the most unfathomable depths of Stalinist cruelty became known, actually strengthened the appeal of left-wing reform in the early 1930s. Soviet communism seemed to be producing a dynamic egalitarian society that offered a viable alternative to the moribund capitalist economic order. Soviet leaders sparked the interest of American intellectuals in 1928 by announcing their first five-year plan, which promised a rational, centralized economy that would create abundance by unleashing science and technology. Socialists and progressives had long favored intelligent planning over a seemingly anarchic system in which individual capitalists made decisions based on maximizing profits. The concept of planning had inspired works as disparate as Edward Bellamy's 1888 socialist masterpiece, Looking Backward, and Walter Lippmann's 1914, Drift or Mastery, the Bible of the progressive movement. Many intellectuals agreed with the editor of The Nation, Oswald Garrison Villard, who in late 1929 described the Soviet Union as the greatest human experiment ever undertaken. The results seem to justify that description. While the United States and the rest of the capitalist world plunged deeper into depression, the Soviet economy appeared to be booming. In early 1931, the Christian Science Monitor reported that not only was the Soviet Union the only country to have escaped the depression, its industrial production had jumped an astronomical 25% the previous year. In late 1931, the nation's Moscow correspondent described the Soviet frontier as a charmed circle which the world economic crisis cannot cross. While banks crash abroad, the Soviet Union continues in an orgy of construction and national development. The Nation could be dismissed as a liberal publication, but similar reports in Barron's, Businessweek, and the New York Times were harder to disregard. As the U.S. unemployment rate approached 25%, a Times report that the Soviet Union intended to hire foreign workers caused desperate jobless Americans to stampede Soviet offices in the United States. Despite official Soviet disclaimers, Businessweek reported that the Soviets planned to import 6,000 Americans and that 100,000 had applied. Soviet society seemed to be undergoing an incredible transformation from agrarian backwardness to industrial modernization before people's eyes. Many American intellectuals had also begun to see the Soviet Union as a place of intellectual, artistic, and scientific vibrancy, compared with the United States' stultifying bourgeois culture. In 1931, economist Stuart Chase wrote, "For Russians, the world is exciting, stimulating, challenging." The next year, he asked, "Why should Russians have all the fun of remaking a world?" New Republic literary editor Edmund Wilson noted that when visiting the Soviet Union, he felt as if he were at the moral top of the universe where the light never really goes out. Socialized medicine for all, remarkable scientific breakthroughs, dazzling economic growth. Soviet progress, many Americans believed, was vastly eclipsing that of its economically struggling capitalist competitors. Indications of Soviet success added enormously to the appeal of the Communist Party of the United States of America, CPUSA, at a time when so many Americans were looking for alternatives. An invigorated Communist Party would contribute significantly to the growth of 1930s radicalism, but it was only one piece in a much larger puzzle. Many groups, some having nothing to do with the CP, became radicalized during this decade. Radicalization proceeded at different paces for different groups. The first to respond were the unemployed. Hundreds of thousands demonstrated for jobs and relief all over the country on March 6, 1930. Intellectuals followed suit, rejecting the shallow materialism of American life in the 1920s and the anti-intellectualism that had driven so many writers and artists to Europe for cultural salvation. Edmund Wilson captured this perfectly when he wrote in 1932, "To the writers and artists of my generation, who had grown up in the big business era and had always resented its barbarism, these years were not depressing, but stimulating. One couldn't help being exhilarated at the sudden and unexpected collapse of the stupid, gigantic fraud. It gave us a new sense of freedom, and it gave us a new sense of power to find ourselves still carrying on while the bankers, for a change, were taking a beating." The upsurge among workers started in 1933, as the economy showed early signs of recovery, and continued throughout the decade. The year 1934 saw major strikes in Toledo, Minneapolis, and San Francisco, as well as a national textile strike, as workers turned to Musteites, Trotskyists, and communists for leadership. Unemployed councils and unemployed leagues brought in jobless workers to support the strikes, rather than take jobs as strikebreakers. With broad support from all sectors of the working class, these strikes often spread to other industries, even shutting down entire cities, as happened in San Francisco. The Los Angeles Times reported, "The situation in San Francisco is not correctly described by the phrase general strike. What is actually in progress there is an insurrection, a communist-inspired and led revolt against organized government. The Portland Oregonian called for presidential intervention. San Francisco, paralyzed, is in the throes of violent insurrection. Portland faces the practical certainty of a general strike within a few days that will similarly paralyze this city. The San Francisco Chronicle complained, "The radicals have wanted no settlement. What they want is revolution." This was a welcome change after 13 years in which the unions had taken a pounding and suffered sharp declines in membership. Aided by New Deal legislation that helped level the playing field between management and labor, the labor movement even began to penetrate heavy industry, with the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations in 1935. Communists played a major role in the organizing. Corporate resistance often resulted in violent and bloody confrontations. But militant workers adopted new tactics, like sit-down strikes, that proved particularly effective in the right circumstances. African Americans' economic hardship was exacerbated by racism and discrimination. Black unemployment skyrocketed as the Depression effectively eliminated an entire category of Negro jobs. Urban black unemployment reached over 50% in the South in 1932. The North was not much better. In Philadelphia, black unemployment topped 56%. Many blacks, struggling for both jobs and civil rights, thought the legalistic approach of the NAACP was too slow, given the tenor of the times, and turned instead to the CP and its front organizations. Though the National Party leaders may have taken their marching orders from Moscow, that information often did not trickle down to the grassroots level. And scientists, who were among the most conservative groups in the country at the start of the decade, in 1933, sociologist Reed Bain called them the worst citizens of the Republic because of their apathy and social irresponsibility, had been transformed into one of the most radical by decade's end, standing in the forefront of the anti-fascist movement and questioning whether capitalism thwarted the socially beneficial application of science and technology. In the December 1938 election for president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the nation's largest body of scientists, the five leading vote-getters were leaders of the left-wing science and society movement, and the winner, renowned Harvard physiologist Walter Cannon, was one of the most openly left-wing scientific activists in the country. During those turbulent years, many liberals began calling themselves socialists or radicals. Minnesota Governor Floyd Olson proclaimed, "I am not a liberal, I am a radical." For many on the left, even liberalism connoted a moderation that bordered on cowardice. Lillian Simes wrote in The Nation in 1934, "No worse insult than being called a liberal could be hurled at anyone's mentality at a time like this." Many felt the same way about joining the socialists when the Communist Party seemed to offer a viable and more radical alternative. John Dos Passos explained his support of the communists in 1932. "Becoming a socialist right now would have just the same effect on anybody as drinking a bottle of near beer." Ironically, during the 1935-39 Popular Front period, when the communists garnered their greatest support, Norman Thomas's socialists were often to the left of the communists, who deliberately toned down their rhetoric in hope of building a broad coalition against fascism. Hundreds of thousands of Americans joined the Communist Party or worked with its affiliated organizations. Among them were many of the country's best writers, including Ernest Hemingway, Erskine Caldwell, John Dos Passos, Edmund Wilson, Malcolm Cowley, Sinclair Lewis, Langston Hughes, Sherwood Anderson, James Farrell, Clifford Odets, Richard Wright, Henry Roth, Lillian Hellman, Theodore Dreiser, Thomas Mann, William Carlos Williams, Nelson Algren, Nathaniel West, and Archibald MacLeish. But as the 1930s advanced, Western intellectuals' early enthusiasm for Soviet communism began to wane. Encircled by hostile capitalist nations and fearing a new war, Joseph Stalin embarked upon a policy of breakneck industrialization that would claim many victims. Reports filtered out of the Soviet Union of famines and starvation, political trials and repression, ham-fisted bureaucracy, secret police, brutal prisons, and ideological orthodoxy. Kulaks were slaughtered for resisting forced collectivization of agriculture. More than 13 million people died under Stalin's despotic rule. Organized religion was stifled. Military leaders were purged. And even those who refused to believe the horrific reports filtering out of the Soviet Union were shocked by Stalin's apparent treachery in concluding the non-aggression pact with Germany in 1939. Communists left the party in droves at that point, but diehards blamed Stalin's about-face on Western capitalist nations' refusal to assist the Soviet Union in stopping Hitler, despite Stalin's persistent calls for collective defense. The combination of a left-leaning Congress, an energized progressive populace, and a responsive and caring president made possible the greatest period of social experimentation in U.S. history, especially after the upsurge in mid-decade radicalism drove the New Deal farther left. In December 1935, Harold Ickes told the president that he believed the general sentiment of the country to be much more radical than that of the administration. Roosevelt agreed and sharpened his attack on the business community. He saved his heaviest artillery for his annual message to Congress on January 3, 1936, which he delivered at night over national radio. The only previous time that a president had addressed an evening session was on April 2, 1917, when Wilson read his war message to the House. Roosevelt lashed out at his enemies on the right. "We have earned the hatred of entrenched greed. They seek the restoration of their selfish power. Give them their way, and they will take the course of every autocracy of the past. Power for themselves, enslavement for the public." Having been pushed to the left by the progressive upsurge, Roosevelt kept up his harsh attack on business throughout the 1936 campaign. He trumpeted the list of progressive achievements, the Works Progress Administration, WPA, and other government programs put millions of unemployed back to work in government jobs. The economic and banking systems had been reformed. The government, for the first time, sided, however tentatively, with labor against the employers and nurtured the growth of unions. Social Security guaranteed a modicum of comfort in old age that few workers had previously enjoyed. The tax burden was shifted increasingly to the wealthy. On the eve of the election, Roosevelt took his defiantly anti-business message to supporters at Madison Square Garden, declaring, "We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. We know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred." When Election Day came around, the revitalized Democrats gave the Republicans the political thrashing of their lives at every level. Roosevelt defeated Kansas Governor Alf Landon 523-8 in the Electoral College, winning every state except Maine and Vermont. Democrats gleefully amended the old saying that, "As goes Maine, so goes the country," to declare, "As goes Maine, so goes Vermont." The Democrats controlled the House 331-89, and the Senate 76-16. After accounting for the farmer laborites and George Norris's switch to independent, The Chicago Tribune saw the lopsided vote as an unambiguous endorsement of the president's agenda. The result of the election is a vote of confidence in Mr. Roosevelt and the New Deal. He will enter upon his second term with what amounts to a blank check, signed yesterday by an overwhelming majority of the American people. The conservative Tribune worriedly pointed to the coalition Roosevelt had formed with the former labor, American labor, socialist, and communist parties. How Mr. Roosevelt will discharge his obligations to his radical partners becomes a matter of intense interest. But the near-universal hopes for further reform would be frustrated by political and economic miscalculation on the part of the usually savvy president. Roosevelt lost momentum following the election with his ill-fated scheme to pack the Supreme Court with progressive judges, out of frustration with the court's repeated vetoing of New Deal programs. If the New Deal stumbled over the Supreme Court, it was knocked flat by the economic crisis of 1937, which critics quickly dubbed the Roosevelt Recession. Believing incorrectly that economic progress was self-sustaining and the Depression's end in sight, administration officials decided to cut spending and balance the budget. Roosevelt particularly targeted the WPA and PWA for deep cuts. The economy plummeted almost overnight. In fact, the collapse was so stunning that Roosevelt and other administration officials believed it was deliberately staged by businessmen seeking to bring Roosevelt down. Stocks rapidly lost one-third of their value, and corporate profits fell by 80%. Unemployment skyrocketed anew as millions lost jobs. Reformers were now on the defensive. Despite that, many Americans realized that one essential human need had yet to be addressed and set out to correct that oversight. Few people appreciate how close the United States came to adopting a national health care program in 1938 and 1939. The Committee of Physicians for the Improvement of Medical Care, an insurgent group of progressive physicians, largely based at the nation's most prestigious medical schools, acting in defiance of the conservative American Medical Association, sparked a national movement to create a sweeping national health care system. The administration threw its weight behind the effort, arguing that health care was a right, not a privilege, a position strongly supported by labor and a broad range of reform-minded organizations. In fact, administration support was so strong that the editors of The Nation were convinced that no government would so mobilize public opinion or put such expert effort and the time and attention of more than half of its cabinet officials into the development of such a program and then abandon it. In late February 1939, New York Senator Robert Wagner submitted his administration-backed bill for a national health program, claiming that no legislation had received more widespread approval from the American people. But faced with vehement AMA opposition and seeking to avoid a nasty fight with elections approaching, Roosevelt decided to abandon the effort. New Deal reform was over once and for all. The progressive reforms that the New Dealers had been able to implement provoked sharp opposition from the still powerful business community. Roosevelt and advisor Rexford Guy Tugwell, agency heads Harry Hopkins and David Lilienthal, and progressive cabinet members like Henry Wallace, Harold Ickes, and Francis Perkins, incurred the wrath of much of the business and banking communities. Though some businessmen, like Joseph Kennedy, thanked Roosevelt for rescuing capitalism from short-sighted capitalists, most considered him the enemy and fought the New Deal every step of the way. A U.S. Chamber of Commerce membership survey registered 97% opposition to the philosophy of the New Deal. The most extreme of these right-wing businessmen set out to prove that the New York Times obituary for the Republican right was premature. They announced formation of the American Liberty League in August 1934, a few months before the midterm elections, although they had begun gathering forces long before that. The American Liberty League was the brainchild of members of the DuPont family, including brothers Irene, Pierre and Lamotte, and in-law and top executive Robert Rooley Carpenter. Carpenter alleged that Roosevelt was being controlled by Felix Frankfurter and his 38 hot dogs, a gang of fanatical and communistic Jew professors. He recruited John Raskob, former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, to the cause. Raskob, a strong proponent of shifting the tax burden from the wealthy to the working class, had engineered DuPont's purchase of General Motors and had simultaneously served as a chief financial officer in both corporations. Others brought on board included GM President Alfred Sloan, former Democratic presidential candidates Al Smith and John Davis, National Steel Corporation President Ernest Weir, Sun Oil Company President J. Howard Pugh, and General Foods Chairman E.F. Hutton. Charles Lindbergh turned down the League's offer to serve as president. The American Liberty League went public on August 22, 1934, announcing its intention to combat radicalism, defend property rights, and uphold the Constitution. Headed by Jouett Schaus, former chairman of the Democratic Executive Committee, the five-member executive committee included Irene DuPont, Al Smith, John Davis, former New York Republican Governor Nathan Miller, and New York Republican Congressman James Wadsworth Jr. Schaus announced plans to recruit 2 million to 3 million members and hundreds of thousands of contributors. The League unfurled a massive, though largely ineffectual, education campaign over the next few years in a concerted effort to stem the liberal tide. It fell far short, however, of its recruitment and fundraising targets, claiming 125,000 members and 27,000 contributors. But most of the members were inactive, and most of the funds came from the DuPonts and a handful of other right-wing businessmen. Its reputation was also tarnished by two damning congressional investigations of 1934 and 1935. The first investigation was short-lived, but shocking in its implications. In November 1934, highly decorated retired Marine General Smedley Butler told the House Special Committee on Un-American Activities that William Doyle, commander of the American Legion's Massachusetts branch, and bond salesman Gerald McGuire had tried to recruit him to organize a military coup against the Roosevelt administration. Paul Comely French, a reporter for the New York Evening Post and the Philadelphia Record, corroborated Butler's account, testifying that he overheard McGuire say at one point, "We need a fascist government in this country to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built in America. The only men who have patriotism to do it are the soldiers, and Smedley Butler is the ideal leader. He could organize 1 million overnight." McGuire had gone to France to study fascist veterans movements, which he envisioned as a model for the force Butler could organize in the United States. Butler rejected McGuire's entreaties. "If you get the 500,000 soldiers advocating anything smelling of fascism," he warned, "I am going to get 500,000 more and lick the hell out of you, and we will have a real war right at home." Testimony revealed that Doyle and McGuire were fronting for many of the same Morgan and DuPont-linked bankers and industrialists who had formed the American Liberty League. McGuire denied the charges, and New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia mockingly dismissed the episode as a cocktail putsch. Morgan partner Thomas Lamotte called the allegations purest moonshine, too utterly ridiculous to comment upon. But James Van Zandt, national commander of the American Legion and a future congressman, lent support to Butler's testimony, reporting that agents of Wall Street had also approached him. After hearing the testimony, the House committee, chaired by John McCormack of Massachusetts, reported that it had been able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, except for McGuire's direct solicitation of his services, which it accepted as fact. It concluded that attempts to establish a fascist organization in the United States were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient. The committee, strangely, chose not to call many of those implicated to testify, including Colonel Grayson Murphy, General Douglas MacArthur, Al Smith, former American Legion Commander Hanford McNider, John Davis, Hugh Johnson, and Thomas Lamont. Butler decried the fact that their names had been omitted from the final report. The second set of hearings, which began earlier but lasted longer, was conducted by North Dakota Senator Gerald Nye. Nye had been appointed to the Senate upon the death of his predecessor, and twice reelected. He immediately identified with the progressives, including George Norris, William Borah, and Robert La Follette, sharing their desire to avoid overseas entanglements that might involve the United States in foreign wars, and their opposition to using the military to protect American businessmen's overseas investments. In February 1934, Nye proposed what would become one of the most remarkable congressional investigations in U.S. history. He called upon the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to investigate individuals and corporations involved in manufacturing and selling arms, munitions, and other implements of war. Its targets would include steel, airplane, and automobile manufacturers, arms and munitions makers, and shipbuilders. The focus on arms merchants rather than bankers represented a departure from the views of Harry Elmer Barnes and other revisionist historians who had written blistering critiques of U.S. involvement in the war. Barnes wrote in 1934 that arms dealers never exerted so terrible an influence upon the promotion of warfare as did our American bankers between 1914 and 1917. The idea for the hearings had come from Dorothy Detzer, a tireless peace activist who served as the National Executive Secretary of the U.S. chapter of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Detzer's twin brother had been a victim of mustard gas in the Great War. Needing someone to sponsor the proposal in the Senate, she approached 20 senators. All turned her down. George Norris suggested that she try Nye, who agreed to do it. Peace groups around the country organized support for the resolution. In April, the Senate authorized hearings into the Munitions Trust, focusing on war profiteering, the role of weapons makers' propaganda in pushing the government toward war, and whether the government should have a monopoly of all weapons manufacturing in order to remove the profit motive from war fighting. The resolution's co-sponsor, Senator Arthur Vandenberg, pledged to find out if the country would be allowed to live at peace among ourselves and with our neighbors, and without artificial encouragement of friction and misunderstanding, and then to conflict, and then to disaster. Vandenberg wanted to find out if these sordid intrigues which we know to exist elsewhere were also occurring in the United States. Nye, Vandenberg, and Vice President John Nance Garner selected four Democrats, Homer Bone of Washington, Bennett Champ Clark of Missouri, Walter George of Georgia, and James Pope of Idaho, and three Republicans, Nye, Vandenberg, and W. Warren Barber of New Jersey. Clark nominated Nye as chairman of the special committee investigating the munitions industry, and Pope seconded the nomination. Hearings were delayed to give the committee time to begin its research, which was coordinated by Stephen Rauschenbusch, son of the renowned social gospel minister, Walter Rauschenbusch. A young Harvard law graduate named Alger Hiss served as a legal assistant, on loan from Jerome Frank of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. Progressives rallied to the cause. An article in the Railroad Telegrapher captured the festering anger that many workers still felt toward the munitions makers, a decade and a half after the end of the World War. The American people are showing signs of awakening to the system, which encourages wars, slays and tortures millions to build a few swollen fortunes, and leaves the common man and woman staggering under crushing debts. Labor's millions are called on to fight all wars, to suffer the mud, lice, and blood of the trenches, while the bosses gather their dollars, and the bosses' sons become officers. And, after the war is over, Labor pays and pays and pays. In an editorial titled Murder Incorporated, the New Republic stated that the investigators would have to follow the tortuous track of blood money. The track is there. The blood-dripping profits are there. A vast worldwide network of incorporated murder is there. While the nation waited for the hearings to commence, two important and timely books appeared that fueled public anger and provided more grist for the inquisitors. Merchants of Death by H.C. Engelbrecht and F.C. Hannigan, which was chosen as a Book of the Month Club selection, and Iron Blood and Profits by George Saldus, were released on the same day in April 1934. They detailed not only the sordid dealings of U.S. munitions makers, but those of their compatriots in other parts of the world. Doubleday also reprinted in pamphlet form the startling exposé of the European arms industry from the March issue of Fortune titled Arms and the Men. That article also seethed with visceral anger. It began, "According to the best accountancy figures, it cost about $25,000 to kill a soldier during the World War. There is one class of big businessmen in Europe that never rose up to denounce the extravagance of its governments in this regard, to point out that when death is left unhampered as an enterprise for the individual initiative of gangsters, the cost of a single killing seldom exceeds $100. The reason for the silence of these big businessmen is quite simple. The killing is their business. Armaments are their stock in trade. Governments are their customers. The ultimate consumers of their products are, historically, almost as often their compatriots as their enemies. That does not matter. The important point is that every time a burst shell fragment finds its way into the brain, the heart, or the intestines of a man in the front line, a great part of the $25,000, much of it profit, finds its way into the pocket of the armament maker." Roosevelt voiced approval of the hearings and urged stronger international steps to curb what he called the mad race in armament, which, if permitted to continue, may well result in war. "This grave menace to the peace of the world," he added, "is due in no small part to the uncontrolled activities of the manufacturers and merchants of engines of destruction." The committee's 80 researchers and accountants combed the books of the United States' leading corporations. Committee members were astonished by the findings. Senator Pope promised that the people will be amazed by the story of greed, intrigue, war scare propaganda, and lobbying, which will be made public during the hearings. He added that the information would shock the entire nation when disclosed. Just before the start of hearings, the New York Times reported that a majority of the 7 committee members favored complete government operation of war materials manufacturing plants. Pope expressed optimism that the evidence would be so disturbing that there would be almost universal demand for such actions. On September 12th, Felix, Irene, Lamotte, and Pierre DuPont took the stand together and were grilled about the firm's enormous profits during the war years. The company had received orders of $1.245 billion between 1915 and 1918, a 1,130% increase over company orders in the 4 years prior to the war. During the war, DuPont had paid 458% dividends on original par value stock. The hearings that day also revealed that in 1932, Army Chief of Staff General Douglas MacArthur had gone to Turkey, where, according to a letter from an executive of the Curtis Wright Corporation, he had apparently talked up American military equipment to the skies in discussions which he had with the Turkish General Staff. At that point, Nye interjected, "It looks to me like General MacArthur was pretty much of a salesman. It makes one begin to wonder if the Army and Navy is just a sales organization for private industry." The hearings produced troubling revelation after troubling revelation. U.S. and foreign arms dealers had divided foreign markets through cartel arrangements, sharing secrets and profits, and designing German submarines that were busy sinking Allied ships during World War I. More recently, American companies had been helping Nazi Germany rearm. Officials of United Aircraft and Pratt & Whitney testified that they had sold planes and aircraft equipment to Germany for, they claimed, commercial, not military use. Nye was incredulous. "Do you mean to say," he asked, "that through all of these negotiations you hadn't the ghost of an idea that Germany was buying for military purposes?" U.S. policy since 1921, Secretary of State Cordell Hull reiterated, had been to oppose the sale of any military equipment to Germany. Support for the hearings came in from across the political spectrum, as the committee landed blow after blow. In late September, John Thomas Taylor, the legislative representative of the American Legion, announced that he supported the plan proposed by the earlier War Policies Commission to have the government seize 95% of any abnormal profits in wartime. Nye promptly announced that he would introduce legislation raising income taxes to 98% on all incomes above $10,000 on the day the United States entered a war in order to entirely eliminate war profits. Nye said that he and two other committee members actually preferred to nationalize the entire arms industry in the event of another war. Public interest in the hearings was tremendous. England made plans to hold its own hearings. Hearings were already underway in several Latin American countries, spurred by disturbing revelations about nefarious dealings between those countries and the arms makers. Nye had received more than 10,000 congratulatory letters and telegrams. He was being flooded with speaking requests. The adulation made the Washington Post nervous. It editorialized that the outpouring of support was no surprise because the inquiry revealed much information of a sensational character and gave to the average citizen a new conception of the uncontrolled forces which combat, in effect, if not in intent, the efforts to secure world peace. To see glaring publicity given to what has been essentially a secret traffic evoked a responsive chord among all who desire a better world order. The Post begrudgingly praised the committee's excellent work. In early October, Nye gave a national address over NBC Radio, in which he defended his plans for nationalizing the arms industry and sharply increasing wartime taxes. "Do that, and then observe the number of jingoists diminish," he suggested. "If such steps were taken," he confirmed, "war may not be as unpreventable as pictured." He summarized the committee hearings to that point. The committee listened daily to men striving to defend acts which found them nothing more than international racketeers, bent upon gaining profit through a game of arming the world to fight itself. Calls for nationalization by Nye and other committee members sparked a vigorous national debate in late 1934. In December, the Washington Post poo-pooed Nye's proposals and referred leaders to an op-ed piece insisting that the topic had been thoroughly vetted in Geneva for the past 15 years, and that it was an undisputed fact that enlightened opinion was against it. The DuPonts and others weighed in along similar lines. Commentators pointed out the problems with Nye's plan. If the weapons industry were nationalized, Walter Lippmann asked, how would the United States decide about exporting weapons to other countries? If the United States nationalized its weapons industry, would other countries follow suit? If so, what would happen to countries with no munitions plants? How would determination be made about the many products that could be used for commercial as well as military purposes? The Chicago Tribune pointed specifically to Japan's buying scrap metal in the United States and cited the DuPont's contention that bales of cotton could be munitions of war. Others asked what would happen to the war industries during peacetime. And if the factories were obsolescent and unused, would the nation be able to gear up quickly enough to meet an emergency? With public pressure building for decisive action, Roosevelt decided to get out ahead of and defuse the issue. On December 12th, he announced that he had asked a high-powered group of government and industrial leaders to come up with a plan to end war profiteering. Roosevelt told the reporters, "The time has come to take the profits out of war." 3 hours later, the group met at the White House to begin its work. Arriving arm in arm were none other than the commission chairman, Bernard Baruch, and Hugh Johnson, the commission's executive director. Others asked to assist with drafting the legislation included the secretaries of state, war, labor, agriculture, treasury, and navy, rail coordinator Joseph B. Eastman, Army Chief of Staff MacArthur, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of Agriculture Tugwell, Assistant Secretary of Labor Edward F. McGrady, and George Peck, the head of the Export-Import Bank. Nye committee members erupted in anger, accusing the administration of trying to restrict their inquiry before the investigation was completed. Others also voiced skepticism about Roosevelt's motives. Washington Post columnist Raymond Clapper listed several explanations that were circulating around Washington. One was that the president wanted to steal the spotlight from Nye and Vandenberg, the Republican senators who were making headlines with their investigations. Another was that the munitions interests have got to the administration and that it is trying to take them off of the spot. Nye thought Roosevelt was up to no good. The departments of our government are really co-defendants with the munitions industry and the profiteers, he exclaimed, having only recently become sensitive to the degree of government complicity in international arms sales. Refusing to let the administration steal its thunder, the Nye Committee came out with more headline-grabbing exposés. The DuPonts remained in Nye's crosshairs. Alger Hiss revealed more evidence of untrammeled greed. The Washington Post headlined one December 1934 front-page article, 800% war profit told at inquiry. DuPont deal up. Hiss released a list of companies involved in various aspects of war production and the gaudy returns on their investments. He also released names of the 181 individuals who reported incomes exceeding $1 million in 1917 and noted that 41 of them had appeared for the first time. The list included 6 DuPonts, 4 Dodges, 3 Rockefellers, 3 Harknesses, 2 Morgans, 2 Vanderbilts, 2 Whitneys, and only 1 Mellon. The more blood Nye drew, the shriller the attacks on the committee became. The Chicago Tribune condemned the committee's method of damning witnesses as unjust, dishonorable, and disgusting. But support for the investigation remained strong. Nye met with Roosevelt in late December. The committee had received over 150,000 friendly letters by that point. Afterward, Nye assured reporters that he had mistaken Roosevelt's motives. The president was entirely behind the investigations, he said, and no new legislation would be forthcoming until the investigation had run its course. Members of the committee tried to warn the public about what they feared was an impending European war. Pope thought it paradoxical that governments around the world were aiding munitions manufacturers. Countries, he regretted, seem to be in the grip of some monster that is driving them to destruction. Preparations for the next war are feverishly underway. That it is inevitable is widely assumed. In early February 1935, Representative John McSwain of South Carolina introduced legislation that would freeze prices at the level they were at on the day war was declared. Baruch and Johnson both testified on behalf of the legislation, and both opposed Nye's more sweeping nationalization proposals. Meanwhile, at the hearings, Eugene Grace, president of Bethlehem Steel Corporation and the Bethlehem Shipbuilding Corporation, admitted that his company's profits jumped from $6 million before the war to $48 million once the war started, and that he had received personal bonuses of $1,575,000 and $1,386,000. Senator Bone aggressively questioned him about Treasury Department charges that Bethlehem profits were unconscionable and unjust, the subject of an $11 million suit that had been tied up in the courts for years. In February, the committee weighed a request to open up a new line of inquiry. The annual convention of the Department of Superintendents of the National Education Association, NEA, heard a powerful indictment of the insidious influences of press magnate William Randolph Hearst, by former president of the American Historical Association, Charles Beard. Beard claimed that Hearst has pandered to depraved tastes and has been an enemy of everything that is noblest and best in our American tradition. According to the Times, when Beard finished, the 1,000 educators in attendance rose to their feet and applauded for several minutes. The association passed a resolution declaring that NEA members had been shocked and outraged by the iniquitous greed for profits on the part of American munitions manufacturers, as has been revealed in all the grossness of their corruption by the Nye Committee. The resolution called upon the committee to also investigate the propaganda in newspapers, schools, motion pictures and radio, carried forward to increase the fear of war and promote the sale of munitions, specifically including the Hearst newspapers. Nye responded that such an investigation did fall within the purview of his committee and requested more information. But, after further consideration, he decided against the inquiry. In late March, a Senate bill to ban war profits started to take shape. The New York Times described it as a plan that is admittedly the most radical in the history of the government. The Washington Post concurred, describing it as a plan so drastic in its confiscatory features that 6 months ago it would have been scoffed at.